It's a great pleasure to be here with you. You know, I was thinking, some years ago, my Dharma brother, Ed Brown, asked Suzuki Roshi, "Roshi, what's the most important thing?" And Suzuki Roshi said, "To find out what's the most important thing." And as I consider that question, it seems to me that the most important thing is how we live this brief and precious life that's been given to us. I have had the greatest inspiration in my life, not from what people have said, but from how they are. What kind of person are they? When I met Suzuki Roshi, I wanted to be like that. You know, he was a very present and very compassionate person. He met me completely, and it seemed like, you know, he said once, "You should see Buddha in everyone," and it seemed like that's what he did. And it seemed to me remarkable that he could see Buddha in everyone, including me. And I really wanted to be like that, and so I said, well, if he sits Zazen, I'll sit Zazen. But this question of how we live our life is, of course, the Buddha talked about that a lot. You know? There are a great many practices in the Buddha Dharma for helping us to see a more skillful way to live our life when we run into difficulties. One of the fundamental teachings of Buddhism is the law of cause and effect, or action and the result of action. You know, the word karma means volitional action. It's somehow come over into English as if it means the result of action. But the Sanskrit word for the result of action is vipaka. So karma means volitional action. And the theory is, as it's taught in Buddhism, is that wholesome actions of body, speech, and mind will lead to wholesome results. And unwholesome actions of body, speech, and mind will lead to unwholesome results. And as we begin to be more attentive to our life and more attentive to our actions of body, speech, and mind, we begin to notice that some actions have results that we appreciate more than other actions. So the more actually we are developing our mindful awareness of how we live our life, the more we begin to choose those actions whose consequences we appreciate. And the more we begin to step back from those actions whose consequences we find are difficult. So it's very much in the realm of mindful awareness of what we're doing. And of course, you all know this, right? You've been studying this with Gil for some time. But one of the things that I do in my practice is help people prepare for a ceremony of taking refuge in the triple treasure of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and receiving the precepts, the 16 Bodhisattva precepts. And this practice of precepts is very central to Zen. It's considered the lifeblood of Zen. We have, when we receive precepts, we receive a document that has a red, it's called the blood vein, actually, Kechimyaku. And it begins with an empty red circle, which represents, I think, Dharmakaya Buddha. And then the red line goes through Shakyamuni Buddha and his disciples, and, you know, in Zen we have a lot of emphasis on lineage. So through the whole lineage, down to your teacher and you, and then this red line goes back up to the red circle. It's a continuous flowing of this blood vein of precepts through the lives of the Buddha and all his disciples, through your teacher and you. And the symbolism of this for me is that the life of the Buddha depends on the person who is practicing right now. The continuity of the life of the Buddha the continuity of this blood vein of precepts depends on each one of us. Buddha is kept alive in the world through our actions. Precepts are not rules to follow. Precepts are simply a description of how a Buddha lives, how an awake being lives. And we practice to become more awake to our actions of body, speech, and mind, more awake to our motivations, to to how we feel about what we're doing and thinking and saying. Suzuki Roshi said, if you break a precept, it doesn't mean that someone will punish you. It may just mean that you'll feel bad. And actually, in my experience, that's how I know I've broken a precept. Something feels off to me, and then I think, what precept was that? And I will notice, there's one in the precepts that we have that says not praising self at the expense of others. It means, literally, it's more like not putting yourself up by putting others down. I find that slipping into my mind from time to time, and it's praising myself. I have this lovely little self-regulator in me. I'm not sure how I came about it, but it's really nice. If I do something and I think, oh, that was nice, I will stub my toe or bump into a table or step on something. Something will immediately kind of jar me into, don't you think you're cute? What are you doing? This particularly happens in our tradition. We have quite a lot of ritual, and someone who's ordained as a priest often leads the ritual. And so I'll offer the incense, and I'll think, oh, that was really nicely done. And as I'm turning to walk back and bow, I'll stub my toe on the bowing mat. I mean, just almost instantly, I will get a reminder of where my mind is going. And it's particularly bad if I think, I wonder if they noticed how nicely that was done. This self-concern comes up and crowds out attention to what I'm doing. So this teaching is that wholesome actions will produce wholesome results, and unwholesome actions will produce unwholesome results, and these results will occur in an instant like that, or somewhere later down the line. And so that what our life is now is the result of all of the actions of body, speech, and mind which have preceded this moment, and all of the causes and conditions of our life. And our actions now will be contributing to the condition of what we experience in the future. So this idea that we have of good and bad or good and evil doesn't really apply. It's more about we're acting either out of insight into the truth of cause and effect, or the truth of the interconnectedness of all things, or we're acting out of ignorance of cause and effect, or ignorance of the interconnectedness of all things. And once we realize the relationship between cause and effect and the true interrelatedness of all things, we act out of insight or wisdom. From the perspective of Zen, we don't need to try to change our behavior as much as we need to try to bring our attention to our actions and the effects. And the effects that they have on ourselves and on others. And when we really understand or really realize the unwholesome effects of our unwholesome actions, we'll stop. There's one teacher whom I much admire, who taught here on the peninsula, Koben Shino Roshi. He taught up at Jikoji. He died about a year ago. But he said once, during a sesshin, sesshin is generally a 7-day intensive meditation retreat. A sesshin that was called Denko-ei. Denko is light, so it's a gathering for the collecting and transmitting of light, maybe. And as the main subject of Denko-ei is how to become a transmitter of actual light, life light. Practice takes place to shape your whole ability to reflect the light coming through you and to regenerate your system so the light increases its power. Each precept is a remark about hard climbing, maybe climbing down. You don't use the precepts for accomplishing your own personality or fulfilling your dream of your highest image. You don't use the precepts in that way. The precepts are the reflected light world of one precept, which is Buddha's mind itself, which is the presence of Buddha. Zazen, which is what we call our Zen sitting, Zazen is the first formulation of the accomplishment of Buddha existing. I love that. The more you sense the rareness and value of your own life, the more you realize that how you use it, how you manifest it, is all your responsibility. We face such a big task. So naturally, such a person sits down for a while. It's not an intended action. It's a natural action. So the more you sense the rareness and value of your own life, of this life that we've been given, this gift. You know, I had a heart attack a number of years ago. And as I was leaving the hospital, I thought, wow, I'm alive. I could be dead. The rest of my life is just a gift. And then I thought, well, my whole life has been. Too bad I didn't notice it before now. You know? It's all a gift. So this precious life we've been given, how do we manifest it? How do we use it? How do we live? So, you know, we decide, well, let's live like a Buddha. Let's follow the precepts, which are a description of how a Buddha lives. The first precept, actually, in our tradition is taking refuge in Buddha, which taking refuge, the Japanese word that we translate as taking refuge, we say namu kie butsu. We sew one of these little Buddha robes and we say namu kie butsu, namu kie ho, namu kie so. Now, I take refuge in Buddha, I take refuge in Dharma, I take refuge in Sangha, with each stitch. You know? But this namu kie, which we translate as taking refuge, in the literal meaning, namu actually is a Sanskrit word, which literally, the closest word I've found is the Hebrew word amen, or oh yes. And kie is two characters. Ki means to plunge into without reservation. And the e means to rely on. So to plunge into and rely on Buddha, on awakening, on the awakened mind, or the mind of awakening. And to plunge into and rely on the community of practitioners. And to plunge into and rely on the teaching of the Buddha. And I like to say it in Japanese because it has so much more juice in it for me somehow. This wholehearted, just Katagiri Roshi used to say, just dive into the ocean of Buddha. And I really like that feeling of nothing held back. Just really to dive in to awakening. That kind of wholehearted feeling which I have noticed in all of the teachers that have really inspired me. This just sort of complete unhindered wholeheartedness. Of course, that's not for some purpose. It's just for the purpose of wholeheartedness. It's wonderful to have your heart all going in one direction. You know? And it's just, that's another one of the things that I saw in the people who inspired me. That's something about how they live their life. They live their life sort of all of one piece. And so that's been my aspiration as well. I fall short of my aspiration a lot, you know. And I keep trying. We just keep going. Paying attention to what we're doing, doing the best we can, noticing when we fall short of our aspiration, and making a renewed effort, you know. We don't sit around castigating ourselves for making a mistake. We notice we make a mistake. We notice we do something that we feel regretful about. We acknowledge it, and we resolve to, you know, continue our effort. We don't go around also castigating somebody else that we see make a mistake. We actually let them take care of their practice while we're taking care of our practice and try to set a good example for our friends instead of trying to instruct them on how to be a better Buddha. We trust that all of us are making our best effort, and we give our real attention to our own best effort. Traditional Buddhist teaching describes three areas of practice, sila, samadhi, and prajna, or morality or conduct, meditative concentration, and wisdom or insight. And they're usually seen as being cultivated in that order. That is, if your conduct is in keeping with your intention, if your conduct is based on non-harm, then your mind will be calm and settled. If your conduct is unwholesome, your mind will be agitated and ill at ease, and so it will be very hard to arrive at meditative concentration. So the sila supports the meditation, and the meditation supports insight. So these three teachings are sort of taught in that order traditionally. So we don't separate them so much in Zen. We integrate them. But we know that these are there, and we know the importance of our actions to set our mind at ease so that we can sit still and observe our mind. The instructions were given in Zazen don't address the precepts directly, because when we're sitting Zazen, for the most part, we're already maintaining the precepts. When we sit silently, allowing the body to be still and the mind to settle, we're in alignment with the precepts. So practicing zazen is one way to practice with the precepts. And maintaining the precepts allows us to experience the clarity of our being when it's not being directed by our conditioning and habit energy. The first step in working with the precepts is becoming aware of our physical, verbal, mental, and emotional activity, and what about it brings a sense of well-being or uneasiness. The essence of the precepts is non-harming, and to be able to sit still in the first place entails some level of non-harming. I remember once when Shogun Trungpa Rinpoche was speaking at San Francisco Zen Center about 1969 or 70 when he first came to this country, and someone challenged him with a question of, you know, what good does it do to do this or something like this? He said, well, let's see, how many people are there here? Maybe 200, and you've been here for an hour and a half, and you haven't caused anybody any trouble. That's pretty good. So, for me, this taking the precepts, or this taking refuge in the triple treasure of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and then, you know, vowing, actually, the one way that the specific precepts are worded is, a disciple of the Buddha does not kill. A disciple of the Buddha does not take what is not given. It's just describing the actions of a disciple of the Buddha. Thich Nhat Hanh, in wording his precepts in his Sangha, says, aware of the suffering caused by killing, I vow not to kill. So this is another thing, being aware of actions which create suffering, then we make our best effort not to engage in actions which create suffering. Robert Aitken Roshi in his Sangha uses the wording, I take up the training precept of not killing. I take up the training precept of not taking what is not given. So it's also, they're also training body and mind to act in a way that's consonant with our aspiration to be awake. I'd like to share with you one more quotation from another teacher, if I can find it. Katagiri Roshi, who was one of the, he was a Japanese teacher who came to help Suzuki Roshi with Zen Center, and was here for a number of years, and then went and was the abbot of the Minnesota Zen Meditation Center in Minneapolis. And I was thinking about a life of vow, because the precept ceremony is vowing, lots of vowing and bowing. And then I saw this poem by Katagiri Roshi, which I'd like to share with you. It's called Peaceful Life. Being told that it is impossible, one believes in despair. Is that so? Being told that it is possible, one believes in excitement. That's right. But whichever is chosen, it does not fit one's heart neatly. Being asked what is unfitting, I don't know what it is, but my heart knows somehow. I feel an irresistible desire to know what a mystery human is. As to this mystery, clarifying, knowing how to live, knowing how to walk with people, demonstrating and teaching, this is the Buddha. From my human eyes, I feel it is really impossible to become a Buddha. But this I, regarding what a Buddha does, vows to practice, to aspire, to be resolute, and tells myself, yes, I will just practice right here, now, and achieve continuity endlessly, forever. This is living in vow. Herein is one's peaceful life found. This I, regarding what a Buddha does, vows to practice, to aspire, to be resolute, and tells myself, yes, I will just practice right here, now, and achieve continuity endlessly, forever. This is living in vow. Herein is one's peaceful life found? For me, that suggests deciding the direction I want to walk in this life and just walking in that direction always. I wanted to end early so that we could have some discussion. So if there's something you'd like to bring up, please do. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Why would the other conversation I had with a friend along the same line? That's a realization that many people who have had near death experience share. Mm-hmm. Shakes them up in realizing the value of life. My friend's question was very extreme. He asked in this conversation to me, can you think of a way where I can put myself in a near-death experience without actually harming myself? And he was dead serious about it. I didn't have an answer for it. I'm like, gee, I can't think of it.
It's a shame.
So that, your mention reminded me of that, and it reminded me of my less extreme version of that question, which is, for those of us who haven't had the near-death experience, without my wanting to pause that for myself, like my friend does, how can I shake myself into really realizing that? I mean, logically, when I'm talking about it, when I'm hearing you, when I'm hearing my friend, I do realize that, yes. You know, but it seems like us people in general don't really feel that, don't really believe
or something that brings home to us the impermanence. You know, Dogen Senji, actually Nagarjuna, Dogen Senji is quoting him, says, in this life of birth and death, seeing into impermanence is bodhicitta, is the mind of awakening. And there's a Pali chant, I don't think I have the tune quite right, but it's something like, all things are impermanent, they arise and they pass away. To live in harmony with this truth brings great happiness. And this seeing that everything arises and passes away is, I think, part of the kind of practice that you do, if I'm not mistaken. Really seeing everything arising and passing away, seeing that, and taking that further, that we too arise and pass away. I will have to say that the first near-death experience I had terrified me. I had no realization that, oh wow, life is a gift. I mean, the first near-death experience I had was when I went into septic shock with a pelvic inflammatory disease and very nearly died. And that the death of a close friend of mine, which occurred close together, sent me scurrying around looking for, you know, I'm going to die, you know. What do you do? You know, and actually, Master Mumon has a verse at the end of each case in the Mumon Khan, in one of them, case 17. He says, you'd better pay attention to what I'm saying, or else when it comes time for the five elements to separate, you'll be like a crab in a pot, scrambling with all eight arms and legs to get out. And that was actually my experience this first time, when I really realized, oh, death isn't something that happens to somebody else some other time. It, you know, it's me too. You know, as soon as it got really personal, I was terrified. And I have to attribute the difference in my response to the second time to the fact that I had been sitting zazen for 20 years between that first experience and the second experience. Um, I don't, you know, I'm not actually very skillful at guided meditation, but aren't there in Vipassana training, aren't there meditations on impermanence that really help you to focus on seeing that everything without exception arises and passes away, so that you can begin to, you know, in the Tibetan tradition, they have this slogan, death is certain, time of death is uncertain. But it's very easy for us to kind of ignore the fact that our life is all too brief, and to therefore really give some attention to how do I want to live this brief and precious life? Now, what's the most important thing? And I don't really know how to decide how I want to live other than looking around for good examples and saying, oh, I like that. That's, you know, and at least that's what's been helpful to me, is to see some people who seem to have, I mean, my mother actually, it's very hard for me to realize that my mother was onto something. Because you know how mothers and daughters are. You always want your mother to be somewhat different. It took me many years to recognize that this joie de vivre that she had, she said, I had a happy childhood. I never had any problems. How can she deceive herself that way? I know she had a miserable childhood because I know that. Well, you know, she was at that time 90 years old. Why should she go back and fret over her childhood difficulties, you know? She was onto a lot more than I was, you know? She just said, she just kind of dropped it. Said, my childhood was perfect. Okay. And I don't have to worry about that anymore. It took me years to get there. And a good deal of therapy as well. You know, shortly before she died, she said something like, I'm not ready yet. But the minute she had her fatal heart attack, she just completely went with it. She just did not struggle with it at all. And she didn't want any medication. And I said, would you be willing to have an IV that might help you stick around until the grandchildren get here to say goodbye? And she said, okay. So she had an IV nitroglycerin lidocaine. Till all the grandchildren were there, and each one of them, she'd wake up and say, oh, hello, dear. Thank you for coming. Goodbye. She never sat a day in her life. But she lived for 93 years, and, you know, she learned a lot that way. I don't know. I have to say that I am impressed over and over again with what a fortunate life I had, in spite of various difficulties that happened. But I often wonder, how did I get to live this life, you know? Wow, you know, I look around me and I see a lot of people who are don't seem to be enjoying themselves very much, and I really feel tremendous gratitude for the life I have. But, you know, I'm only half kidding when I say that, you know, how to have a near-death experience. Sit some sesshins. I mean, sit some long sittings and really, you know, really work on letting go of the constant stream of thought and just observe breath rising and falling. Observe body. Just stay with mindfulness of body and breath, and let some of the busyness of your mind fall away. And you'll begin to feel how connected you are with everything. How we're all living one life. You know, all of us are living one life. You know, some people actually are really kind of addicted to life-threatening sports, for example. You know, like skydiving and stuff like that, because it helps to bring up that awareness of the closeness of death. I don't know that that's necessary in order to appreciate this life. Yes.
How about doing a practice like meditation?
That was certainly one of the traditional meditations. We don't have that much access to corpses these days, as but we can bring it to mind. Yeah. Are there other questions? I know it's getting. It's yeah, I think being a hospice volunteer is also very helpful. Yeah, yeah. Just spend some time with people who are dying. And you don't have to do anything. You just sit and breathe with them. You know? Is there any other pressing question? I see it's 9 o'clock, and I'm told that if I don't shut up at 9 o'clock, people will start leaving anyhow. That was my warning. Thank you all very much.